From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation. The prime motive behind the Manhattan Project was the fear that Adolf Hitler would get the bomb first. The German team was led by the brilliant physicist Werner Heisenberg, and people are still arguing over why they failed.
I think I have good evidence, not guesses, but evidence, that Heisenberg was sabotaging them. He did not want to succeed, and indeed he did not.
Dr. Edward Teller is among those who believe Heisenberg was a hero. Others say he didn't have a clue how to build the bomb. The first nuclear arms race is the talk of the nation after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. President Clinton says the Miami family of Elian Gonzalez should respect the law, just like any other special interest group, regardless of the bitter custody battle over the boy.
They should observe the rule of law, just like if they prevail in court, the others should accept it. I have done my best not to overly politicize this, and I don't think we should. There's a legal process here. We ought to let it play out.
The president was speaking in a broadcast news conference this past hour. The boy's great uncle says he'll agree to hand the Cuban boy over to his father, but not to government immigration officials. Lazaro Gonzalez is to meet with INS officials in about an hour. The government wants Gonzalez to pledge in writing that he will hand over the boy if the Miami family fails in its attempts to keep the boy in Florida. The boy's parole status could be revoked as early as tomorrow if his family refuses to sign the document. The president applauded OPEC's move to increase oil production, which should drive prices down. He says this will help truckers who have been hard hit by gas price hikes.
It will also, I hope, bring relief to hard-pressed truckers in this country who have been especially hard hit and others who have high fuel costs by providing a greater balance between oil production and consumption.
In Fort Worth, Texas, searchers are re-examining every floor of downtown office buildings to look for more victims of last night's tornadoes. A pair of twisters hit Fort Worth and part of Arlington, killing at least four people and injuring more than 100 others. Witnesses say the air is filled with the sound of breaking glass. Crews are deliberately pushing broken windows out of their frames to avoid more deaths and injury from falling glass. In Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams says he cannot guarantee the end of violence, but Adams says he does not want further conflict. His comments come as the British and Irish governments are gearing up for new talks aimed at salvaging the peace accord. Marianne McGuire reports from Belfast.
Gerry Adams said it wasn't in the gift of any one group to guarantee that the war is over. He added that he didn't know anyone who wanted the war to start again, but he said that the only way to guarantee it won't happen is for all parties to work collectively, come together and show that politics are working. His comments come as hopes of a rapid breakthrough in the peace process slipped further away. The landmark Good Friday Accord is threatened after Britain collapsed the new government institutions last month. Sinn Féin also says that the deadline for the destruction of all paramilitary weapons will not be met. The peace accord sets May 22nd as a target date for the decommissioning of all guns. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are up 66 points to 11,002.2 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite is down 124 points to 4709. This is NPR. Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream is denying a report in the New York Times of a rift between co-founders Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. An unnamed shareholder told the Times that the company may be sold to private investors by the end of the week, leaving out Jerry Greenfield. Vermont Public Radio Susan Hansen reports.
Ben & Jerry's confirmed that they're in the midst of negotiations, but said nothing's been approved by its board. The Times reported that they'd struck a $260 million deal that would give co-founder Ben Cohen and Meadowbrook Lane Capital each 36% of the company. The remaining 28% would go to Unilever, owner of Breyers Ice Cream. Public relations manager Christy Heimert denied reports that Ben and Jerry disagreed about the deal.
Jerry emphatically stated earlier today that there is no truth to the rumor that there's a rift between he and Ben. That is absolutely not the case.
At $38 a share, analysts say most shareholders would recover their investments, but some say the new structure still won't solve Ben and Jerry's domestic distribution problems. For NPR News, I'm Susan Hansen in Burlington, Vermont.
Demand for new American single-family homes remained strong in February, despite higher mortgage rates and more expensive houses on the market. Five interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve to cool down the economy did not dampen consumers' desire to buy new real estate. The Commerce Department reports the number of homes sold in February dipped only 0.5%. Xerox Corporation is preparing to announce this week that more layoffs are in sight. The corporation is expected to cut about 5,000 jobs and take a one-time first-quarter charge of between $500 million and $900 million. A spokesman for the firm declined to comment on the reports. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, in for Juan Williams. In the fall of 1943, German physicist Werner Heisenberg went to Copenhagen, the capital of Nazi-occupied Denmark, to speak with his mentor, the great physicist Niels Bohr. Their conversation included discussion about the atomic bomb. Could scientists build such a weapon? And, according to Heisenberg anyway, should they? That mysterious meeting is the subject of a new play called Copenhagen by Michael Frayn that speculates on what was said in the course of that conversation and what we can know about it. The play, in turn, has reopened old arguments about what Heisenberg knew and when he knew it. Earlier this week, at a conference in New York City, scientists revisited the issues of theory, ethics, responsibility, and morality that have surrounded the creation, development, and use of nuclear weapons. NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum was there, and he joins us now in the studio. David, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Neil.
Set the scene for us to the degree that you can. What was the significance of this conversation in Copenhagen?
Well, it's really about the question of why Heisenberg didn't build the bomb for the Germans. And Michael Frayn, the playwright, said it's an odd play in that reason because it's about something that didn't happen and why something didn't happen. And there are a couple of theories. One is that Heisenberg intentionally did not build the bomb, that he killed the effort, and that would make him a sort of hero. And other people say he didn't build the bomb because he didn't know how to build the bomb and miscalculated some of the numbers involved.
A hero who worked for the Nazis.
Right. Heisenberg was not a very popular guy at the time because he was running the German nuclear program, and Bohr was his old mentor. They'd met in the 20s. Heisenberg went to Denmark to see a talk of Bohr's, and Bohr was like almost 40 at the time, and Bohr gave this talk, and Heisenberg afterwards took issue with one of his calculations, and Bohr thought that was great, so they apparently went on a walk and became fast friends. So this was also Heisenberg going to visit Bohr to take his counsel, probably. And, you know, Bohr at the same time would soon flee to the U.S. to work on the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm. Both men survived the war and talked about this later, and they at least both agreed on the fact that Bohr emerged from this conversation seriously shaken.
Right. That's probably about the only thing they agree on. They agree that Bohr emerged very angry, and Heisenberg certainly emerged very upset. Bohr has said, there's a lot of secondhand information around. Bohr has talked to people about the meeting, and he said sometimes that Heisenberg had been trying to get information about the Allied bomb project. At the meeting on Monday, I talked to Eugene Mertzbacher, who had talked to Bohr and known Bohr, and he said that Bohr was still in the 60s, was very confused about what exactly Heisenberg had meant and wanted at the meeting. And Heisenberg has come out, and in his memoirs and other places, he has said that he had wanted to urge Bohr not to tell the Allies not to work on a bomb, and so that's his take on it. Heisenberg also says that he always knew the basics of how to build the bomb. And that's also in question.
Why is this 57 years after the fact, and we now know how to build the bomb, perhaps unfortunately, why is this still such a big deal?
I think in part because people feel that Heisenberg's legacy is at stake here, and there are people still around who were at this meeting who knew Heisenberg and feel that they need to stand up for him. Hans Bethe, who was instrumental in the Manhattan Project, stood up and gave a fairly solid defense. One of the reasons that he points out that it seems unlikely that Heisenberg was really focused on building a bomb was that after the war, or as the war was ending, Heisenberg was captured and they were detained rather nicely at an old safe house in England outside Cambridge. And the conversations there with Heisenberg and some 10 or 20 other scientists who were also detained were secretly tape recorded. And when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Heisenberg's reaction, as told by those tapes, is one of shock because he thinks he can't believe at first that it's an atomic bomb explosion. He thinks it must be some chemical explosion. Then he becomes convinced when he hears it on the BBC News that it really was an atomic explosion. And in the coming days, he gives a talk to his colleagues there and where he tries to describe how the bomb might have been put together. And Hans Bethe on Monday said that that Heisenberg's talk was completely wrong, that the talk he was giving was really, he was showing the bomb as if it were a kind of nuclear reactor, which is what Heisenberg had always said he was working on, a source for power, not for an explosion, and that he'd gotten a number of the numbers wrong and that his physics was just wrong.
Well, that might suggest that he was just incompetent.
That's another explanation. But, you know, you have to realize it was a very difficult calculation to do, and it had been done by other people, and it seemed that to build a bomb you needed a lot of uranium, and that was really the question: was what was the so-called critical mass? How much refined uranium did you need to get a sustained chain reaction and a bomb? And Heisenberg over the years had said a ton when he was asked, and he'd also said about as much stuff as would fill up a pineapple. So it's unclear whether he did the calculation and whether he did it correctly. But it took a long time for everybody else to get that calculation right, too.
Thanks very much, David.
You're welcome.
NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum. Our subject this hour is the first nuclear arms race. Did Werner Heisenberg deliberately sabotage the German bomb project, or were his professed claims about morality a post-war invention? More broadly, what does this instance tell us about the ethical issues faced by real scientists in the real world? Do researchers bear responsibility for the development and use of their theories? Should knowledge, even dangerous knowledge, be suppressed? If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. To send us an email, you can write to totn@npr.org. Please include at least your first name and where it is you're writing from. Our guests for the remainder of the hour to talk about Werner Heisenberg are Thomas Powers, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb. He joins us from member station WVPR in Norwich, Vermont. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Tom Powers.
It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Jeremy Bernstein, a professor emeritus of physics at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. He's the author of Hitler's Uranium Club, The Secret Recordings at Farm Hall, and he's speaking to us today from Aspen, Colorado. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, it's a telephone line. We don't have a proper studio here.
Well, we'll try to repair that in the future. Thanks so much. Tom Powers, briefly, can you make the case, I know you make the case, that Heisenberg did indeed work to undermine the German effort to use nuclear explosives?
I think it's important to remember that the German bomb program, and there was a bomb program, came to an end in June of 1942, 3 years before the end of the war, and the very same month that the United States began its program. So we have to ask ourselves, why did Germany abandon a bomb program so early when they had started off with so many advantages? And if we focus on that question, we were immediately struck by the fact that it seems to have been Heisenberg's advice to the authorities that a bomb was too big, too expensive, too uncertain for Germany in wartime that convinced them to drop it. And that puts the focus of our attention on Heisenberg's motives. Why did he give them that advice? The fact that he did give them that advice is well established. Question is, why?
Jeremy Bernstein, you are skeptical of that explanation that Heisenberg was out to prevent the development of an atomic bomb.
Yes, because what he certainly was doing was to attempt to make a nuclear reactor. Could I make a couple of corrections to the beginning, which may be helpful?
Sure.
I believe that the date of the Copenhagen visit was the fall of 1941 rather than 43. It was 43 when Bohr escaped to England in September of 43.
I apologize. That was my mistake, and I was looking at the next paragraph in your book. My mistake.
Right. Those dates are sort of important, 41. They're important because in 1940, by a remarkable one of these coincidences that happened in science, the notion of using plutonium was invented independently by three different groups. One of them was von Weizsacker, who was one of Heisenberg's protege. Another was a curious man called Hadamard, who was working on a parallel project in Germany, a very strange project we can discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And the third was Lewis Turner in the United States. Once plutonium was invented, in the Weizsacker thing, it wasn't exactly plutonium, but it essentially plutonium. Then the distinction between a peaceable nuclear reactor and a weapons program is blurred, because the purpose of a reactor is to make plutonium. And this fact was emphasized by Heisenberg in talks that he gave around 1942 and later. So I think the distinction between the peaceable reactor and the nuclear weapons program disappears once you have plutonium on the table.
As long as we're correcting things, they weren't tape recordings either in 1945. They were recorded on discs. That's one thing. One piece of technology.
I was going to mention that too, because the great pity is that the original discs or whatever they were no longer exist. So at least so the British tell us. So we can't hear the voices. Furthermore, the farm hall transcripts were only transcripts of a small portion of what these guys actually recorded, because the purposes of the transcripts were very different from our historical purposes. There was still some concern that the Germans knew a good deal about nuclear weaponry, and above all, there was a concern that they might jump ship and go east to the Russians. And I have one of the copies of the transcripts that I have is a photostat of the one that was sent to General Groves and has his notations on it. And every time the name the Soviet Union appears, you can see that that Groves has a seismic explosion. There's sort of huge triple exclamation points. You know, these guys say, well, we might go east, and then you see Groves underlining and so on and so forth. But what we miss is all the sort of private conversation that must have taken place at dinner or whatever, which would have been marvelous to know.
Well, Tom Powers, it certainly does seem that the German scientists, and Heisenberg in particular, were certainly surprised. They thought they were way ahead of the Allies.
Well, they were surprised. They had convinced themselves that the Americans probably would not embark upon a big program. But, of course, they had no way of really knowing. And I think more than anything else, they'd kind of hoped the Americans would not do it and thereby deflect all attention from their own efforts, which had come to nothing. While we're correcting things here, I think it's important to point out that while a reactor can make plutonium, a research reactor, a small reactor, cannot possibly make enough plutonium for any kind of military use. In order to make a bomb out of plutonium, you have to build a gigantic reactor on the scale of the one that we built in Washington at Hanford. And that's what the Germans did not do. That's what they abandoned. They made no effort to try and build anything on that scale, and there was no chance whatever that they could have built a bomb with the plutonium that might have been produced from the only reactor they were really working on.
And to extract the right kind of uranium, you would have had to build another huge project on the scale of Oak Ridge.
Another huge factory would have been required, and they never embarked on that as well. That everything that the Germans did was on a small research level that was the equivalent of what might take place in a university laboratory.
Well, that's because they never succeeded in making any reactor at all. I mean, the Fermi reactor, which he made in 1942, was certainly on the level of a research reactor. It was put together by Fermi and Szilard and a few graduate students in a squash court at the University of Chicago. But you had to start there, and the fact that the Fermi reactor actually went critical and worked is, of course, what led to the larger reactors. And to make enough plutonium for bombs, you don't need the stuff that was in Washington. I mean, the Dimona reactor in Israel is a much smaller scale operation, and it's enough puts out enough plutonium for 5 or 6 bombs a year. I think the problem was that they just couldn't get started.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're going to take a short break right now. When we return, we'll continue talking about the role of German physicist Werner Heisenberg in the development of the Nazi A-bomb, and we'll begin taking your calls at 800-989-8255. At 21 minutes after the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. Today we're talking about the intrigue that still surrounds the role of Werner Heisenberg, Germany's leading physicist during the Second World War and the man who headed up that country's nuclear research program. Our guests are Thomas Powers, a journalist and the author of Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb, and Jeremy Bernstein, professor emeritus of physics at the Stevens Institute of Technology, the author of Hitler's Uranium Club, The Secret Recordings at Farm Hall. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And Professor Bernstein, I'm reading a transcript from the Farm Hall report. And this is after the explosion at Hiroshima, but apparently before the German scientists are convinced that it was real. Weissacker says, "I think it's dreadful of the Americans to have done it. I think it's madness on their part." Heisenberg, "One can't say that. One could equally well say that's the quickest way of ending the war." Hahn, "That's what consoles me." Heisenberg, "I still don't believe a word about the bomb, but I may be wrong. I consider it perfectly possible that they have about 10 tons of enriched uranium, but that's but not that they can have 10 tons of pure uranium-235.
Yes. Well, it's very hard to know what to make of this 10 tons, because the critical mass of uranium-235 that's needed is about 60 pounds, so 60 or 100 pounds. So it's really puzzling to know what he's talking about when he talks about the 10 tons. But that night, there was an awful lot of confusion. The most interesting part of that night is that when he took Hahn aside, Otto Hahn and Strassmann had discovered nuclear fission in 1938, and somehow Hahn seemed to be the person that Heisenberg found most sympathetic to talk to, and they went and had a very private talk. In the course of this talk, they discussed the critical mass, and Hahn said something about, "Didn't you tell me earlier that we only needed a fairly small number of kilograms?" And then Heisenberg said that at that point he said, "Well, he'd never really done the calculation," and then which I think is probably correct. I don't think he ever really did the calculation. And then he proceeded to do a calculation for Hahn, which was absolutely wrong. I'm a little puzzled by what your report Beta said, because the calculation of the critical mass that Heisenberg gave in the talk 10 days or so later was not wrong. It was actually a nice calculation. It's not that hard a calculation, actually. as these things go. There are other things in that talk that were completely wrong, but the critical mass calculation is perfectly okay. He left out some things, but basically it's okay.
Well, the question of critical mass is really very important. If it requires a lot of uranium, then you can't build a bomb during wartime. If it only requires a little, then you can. And there is evidence that Heisenberg did actually know roughly what the proper amount of uranium or fissionable material was going to be. He did describe it in the June 1942 meeting with Speer as about the size of a pineapple.
That's Albert Speer, the armaments minister.
He was the armaments minister who had convened this meeting specifically to consider whether Germany should make an all-out effort to build a bomb. Mm. And Hahn also told back in 1940 another German physicist that a few kilograms were sufficient and that Heisenberg had told him that. So we have two kinds of knowledge that Heisenberg seems to be holding at the same time, a roughly accurate, a few kilograms estimate, and then a much larger, a few tons estimate, which was believed by Walter Gerlach, who was the head of the German bomb program, and he was convinced that it would take a few tons. And for that reason, if for no other, there was no German bomb program, but only a reactor research program. So this question of critical mass opens one of these puzzling windows into the ambiguity of Heisenberg's position.
Let's let the listeners get in on this. We're joined now by Jim, who's on the line with us from Canton, Ohio.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Professor Bernstein, I'm a science teacher, and I enjoyed your book, The Life It Brings, and it's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I wanted to take a little different turn here from your discussion so far and reference some of Heisenberg's writings in philosophy and metaphysics. And it might have some bearing on the subject of whether or not he might have, drug his feet a little bit. Let me read a quick passage here from with something he printed in German called Scientific and Religious Truths. Quote, "Even if technology and science could be employed merely as a means to an end, the outcome depends upon whether the goals for whose attainment they are to be used are good ones. But the decision upon goals cannot be made within science and technology only. It is made, if we are not to go wholly astray, at a point where our vision is directed upon the whole man and the whole of his reality." So I would, I guess, just suggest that maybe Heisenberg may have had a lot of second thoughts. Whether he actually sabotaged the program would be a little different from whether he slowed it down a bit.
But at the same time was working for a regime that had driven most of the Jewish scientists out of the country, that was penalizing other scientists. And in fact, the great Hertz was, I think, at the time hiding in a basement.
You mean he's talking about Gustav Hertz?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was actually sheltered by Siemens. That was an interesting thing because Gustav Hertz, whom the people on the project thought, if he'd been allowed to work on it, could have had a great impact. He had Jewish ancestry, but he was sheltered by the industrial company of Siemens during the war, and he remained fairly intact in Germany. Afterwards, he was shipped east to Russia and finally ended up in East Germany. I'd like to talk about the pineapple just a second for a minute. I don't think that my own take on the pineapple, the pineapple-sized bomb, is not that it represented the critical mass, but that represented the amount of mass that would be needed to produce a large nuclear explosion, which is a very different thing. I mean, critical mass is the mass you need before uranium spontaneously explodes. But I think the pineapple represented the amount of mass you would need to fission in order to produce, say, a 20 kiloton equivalent TNT explosion. I think that's what it means, but I'm not sure.
It would be an accurate description of the core of a conventional atomic bomb.
I think that's right. Which I once held in my hand, by the way.
Whoa. Was it warm? They say it's warm.
It was actually warm. It was like a bowling ball in size, and it was a plutonium, and it was warm. I told this to Beta, and he assured me that I was probably not destroyed by it because it was alpha particles and they didn't have much penetration power.
But I bet you were very careful not to drop it.
Very.
Getting back to some of Jim's points and some of the questions it raised, Tom Powers, was Heisenberg a Nazi?
Heisenberg was not a Nazi, and I don't think anybody has ever claimed he was a Nazi. First of all, he was never a member of the party. He was not only not a Nazi, he was not anti-Semitic. There are plenty of people who are angry at Heisenberg, but I don't know of any who've ever seriously charged him with being anti-Semitic. Victor Weisskopf or Hans Bethe, people like that who knew him well in their youth, have certainly never charged him with being anti-Semitic. But he was a German, and he determined to remain in Germany during the war, and that certainly alarmed and troubled all of his old friends. And that was the beginning of the intense suspicion which lingers today about what his motives actually were.
I agree with Tom Powers completely that he was not a Nazi, he was not anti-Semitic. Robbie told me that I.I. Robbie at Columbia told me he offered Heisenberg a job at Columbia in 1939 when Heisenberg was in the United States. And the reason that Heisenberg gave him for not taking the job was he was afraid he would lose his pecking order in the German academic system. Hmm. I mean, it was sort of the strangest thing you could imagine.
Next caller is Keith, who's on the line with us from St. Louis.
Yes, hi. I just had a question for the guest. It's my understanding that at the meeting in Copenhagen with Niels Bohr and Heisenberg, that Heisenberg actually sketched the mechanism that the Germans had been working on in southern Germany, and that when Niels Bohr came to the United States and wound up at Los Alamos, I know for a fact that he passed that sketch on to Oppenheimer and Groves, I believe. But what happened to the sketch, I don't know, but it might help to shed some light on whether or not Heisenberg knew what he was doing. And as for Mr. Tom Powers, certainly Heisenberg was a complete egomaniac, and certainly he wanted to be the first person to be able to make this claim in order to, you know, create his own legacy. So I'd just be interested to see what they have to say about
you,
some
you
of
mean
them.
The claim of the moral high ground?
No, the claim of simply being the first person to devise the technology to create a bomb.
Well, I would say people have accused him of wanting to be the first person to make a reactor. And the sketch that he drew for Bohr at that meeting in Copenhagen was a sketch of a reactor. It was something that Bohr didn't quite understand. And when he arrived in Los Alamos on New Year's Eve of 1943, he brought with him that sketch. And he had alarmed Groves that the Germans were on the verge of making a bomb. So there was a kind of an intense effort to study that sketch and determine whether or not, from what Bohr could tell them, that Heisenberg was close to building a bomb. And Teller and Bethe both worked at that meeting. And they concluded almost instantly that the sketch was of a reactor and that it would not possibly explode. And for a moment or a little while, they thought that Heisenberg might conceivably think that a bomb would be like a reactor. I don't think anybody any longer really thinks that Heisenberg thought a bomb would be a reactor.
Well, on the question of the sketch, here Tom Powers and I disagree pretty radically. I don't believe, and this I am backed up by Ole Bohr, Bohr's son, who was present on the occasion, that Heisenberg ever gave Bohr a sketch in 1943. It would have been very unlike Heisenberg. And if he had wanted to communicate something about the project, why didn't he tell Bohr about plutonium, which he'd known about for nearly 3 years? That was the real secret of the German thing, not some sketch of a rather badly designed German reactor.
And I think that sketch is, you can't dismiss that sketch too easily. Now, I know, Jeremy, that you've talked to Hans Bethe about this.
I've talked to everybody about it.
Well, I'm sure he told you the same thing he told me, specifically that Bohr told him this sketch was made by Heisenberg. I mean, that's certainly what he told me, and I'm sure if you called him up today, that's what he would say. Bohr told him this sketch was made by Heisenberg. Now, why Bohr's son?
That's not what he told me, but he may have changed his mind. I mean, people did not know whether it was a sketch that Bohr had drawn or where it came from. There certainly was a sketch that was shown at this meeting on New Year's Day in Los Alamos. But I don't think anybody is sure that this was a sketch that was given to Bohr by Heisenberg directly.
It would be impossible to be sure about that without having been at the meeting, and we all agree that nobody else was at the meeting except Heisenberg and Bohr. Bohr himself never discussed this sketch, but his son certainly says what you say he says. He said there was no sketch. He didn't know anything about it.
Because you contacted him, and I know that after you contacted him, you asked Pice, who contacted me, and then I was went about to contact everybody who had been at that New Year's Day meeting at Los Alamos to see what their recollections were of what Bohr said and what was passed around.
What did Teller say?
Actually, Teller sent me Teller did not provide directly, but his secretary sent me a letter about a year later saying that Teller had had a stroke and that his memory was impaired, which is a little surprising because it seems to me that when I've heard him speak, his memory has been very good.
I am surprised. I got a letter from him not too long ago, and it certainly didn't seem like he was impaired at all. Mm. Actually, it was sort of end of last summer, last fall.
Ask him his recollection of that meeting, because that's what I learned from him. The person who was most helpful to me is the late Robert Serber, who has a very, very clear memory and also had some documentation which he gave me.
Let me just interrupt for a moment to say that I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay. I think we could go back to the phones now. Keith, thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank you, guys.
Okay. And let's go now to Alex, who's on a car phone in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, well, I'm pulled over, so nobody's shaking their fists at me.
Good.
Though they might after they hear, I'm going to suggest that people need to be very careful about preconceived notions, and sometimes the politics of the day interfere with people's better judgment. Many American Jews just are still very bitter about World War II, as you might well imagine, and they just don't want to give any credit where credit is due. And I noticed that a lot of them conveniently look over some of this evidence. One such book is recently published by a very eminent scholar in World War II, David Irving, who is very controversial because he doesn't maintain that a full 6 million died in the Holocaust.
He is currently involved in a very prominent trial at the moment in London.
That's right. But he's got the unquestioned largest archive of material on World War II because he gets information from both sides. And he documents and footnotes all this information. And the recent book is, I believe the title is Heisenberg's War. And it includes...
Wait a minute. Hold it. That's the title of my book, and I'm not David Irving.
I'm sorry.
Give me a break here.
And I think I would argue that Thomas Powers gets information from both sides as well.
Do you remember what the name of the David Irving book is, though?
It was called The Virus House when it was published in Britain. And it was called The German Atomic Bomb.
He's written a recent book on the Holocaust, I think.
Yeah, but he had one with Heisenberg's title in it. I mean, I have it right on my bookshelf, but I'm not home and I can't pull it down.
Well, the book he wrote, Tom Powers is quite right. The book he wrote on the German program is called The Virus House, and that's got some quite interesting stuff in it, especially about the raid that the British commandos made on the heavy water in Norway.
Well, this talks about specifically Heisenberg's intent to sabotage the German atomic project, and his belief that the American Jewish physicists, who he considered his friends, were also going to do the same. And it would explain why, when he heard that the bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he was surprised, because he thought that, you know, they had kind of a tacit agreement that we were not going to let this genie out of the bottle. He felt certainly that Hitler was irresponsible, and he thought, rightly so, that even the American side would use these weapons, even if they weren't absolutely necessary, which is the question today. Still remains, did we have to drop that bomb on Japan? And a lot of people think we don't. So this is, you know, we need to include information from both sides, even if it's from controversial authors like David Irving. Look at his footnotes. He has everything documented and include this in the debate.
Thanks for your call, Alex.
Thank you.
I'll let you get back on the road. Any evidence of a tacit agreement by scientists to, let's not devise this thing?
No evidence whatever. However, Heisenberg seems to have had some such notion in his mind when he went to see Bohr. There's some evidence that he believed that scientists at that moment had the unique power to allow a program to go forward or to persuade the authorities that it was impractical. And he seems to have hoped that if he persuaded Bohr that the Germans were doing that, that Bohr might be in a position to persuade the Americans. It was a cockamamie scheme, and it certainly came to nothing, and it made Bohr very angry. But it is roughly what Heisenberg did do himself a few months later, in the spring of 1942, when he persuaded Speer that the scientists didn't really have faith in their own program, didn't want a lot of money, and didn't believe it was a smart approach for Germany in wartime.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. My guests are Tom Powers and Jeremy Bernstein. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll continue talking about the ongoing controversy over German physicist Werner Heisenberg, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can send us a card or a letter. Our address, Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. At 40 minutes after the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans, and the W. Alton Jones Foundation for coverage of efforts to reduce threats of nuclear war and proliferation, www.wajones.org. This is NPR National Public Radio.
High-tech communities around the country are luring people from South Asia, and one place they're finding a home is Austin, Texas.
I called up a friend in Austin and asked him two questions. A, is there greenery in Austin? Because I thought whole of Texas was a desert. The other thing I asked him was, is there a good high-tech environment here?
This is Robert Siegel, the changing face of Austin and the news, later today on NPR's All Things Considered.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. Join Juan Williams and guests at this time tomorrow for a special broadcast from Austin, Texas, part of Talk of the Nation series on the changing face of America. They'll be talking about the economic and cultural impact of immigrant entrepreneurs on the capital of the Lone Star State. Today, we're talking about whether German physicist Werner Heisenberg's failure to design and build a nuclear bomb during the Second World War was a deliberate act of conscience or a demonstration of a lack of competence. At Monday's symposium on this subject in New York, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Hans Bethe, who worked on the Manhattan Project, said that even though Heisenberg was in charge of the Nazis' nuclear program, he had no intention of building an atomic bomb.
In mid-1942, the munitions minister of Germany, Speer, asked Heisenberg whether he could produce an atomic bomb in 9 months. With the best of conscience, he could answer no. On other occasions, when his friends asked him how much uranium-235 would be needed for a bomb, his answer was always vague. Sometimes it was 10 kilograms, sometimes it was a few tons. He changed between these figures at random.
Our guests this hour are Tom Powers, author of Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb, and Jeremy Bernstein, professor emeritus of physics at the Stevens Institute of Technology, author of Hitler's Uranium Club, The Secret Recordings at Farm Hall. If you want to get in on the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to the phones. And Carol is on the line with us from Sioux City, Iowa.
Yes. My question is, at the beginning of the program, you posed the question, should certain things be kept secret?
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, can certain things be kept secret in this day and age? With computers that can be hacked into, with the fact that most of our top secret information is available from European journals, is it possible anymore to keep things secret?
That's an interesting question. Jeremy Bernstein, have you given any thought to this?
Well, as a matter of fact, the Los Alamos project was not kept secret because, first of all, we know about the fact that Klaus Fuchs told the Russians the details about the final design of the plutonium weapon. And so Stalin was not surprised when Truman said something at the Potsdam conference about there being such a weapon. But Fuchs wasn't even the only one. There was another fellow's name I can't remember offhand who told the Russians even more. So the thing was porous even then. So I think it's difficult to keep secrets. But I think Tom Powers is an expert on this kind of thing.
Well, I would say that it depends on the kind of secret you're trying to keep. Some secrets are kept securely and more or less forever, and other secrets are kind of hidden in plain sight. I mean, here we are 50 years after the date, more than 50 years, talking about what Heisenberg intended to do during the war. And it's kind of a secret. He himself never clearly explained himself, because whenever he tried to do so, it made his old friend so angry. And somehow, the reality of what happened there has been kept hidden.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, Carol, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Now let's go to Tom, who's on the line with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask if there were any international agreements among scientists at the time that these discussions were supposed to have taken place in Copenhagen that would have prevented the use of advanced scientific research for military purposes or required scientists to keep that research from dictators that were seeking to use it for military uses, such as Hitler. I'd also like to know that if sunset time there have been any international agreements among scientists that would impact on the ethics and morality of the development of advanced areas of research that could be applied to military weapons. And finally, if you'd care to comment on it, I'd like to know if the development of atomic energy sunset era has brought about benefits that balance the nightmare that the development of nuclear weapons has cast upon civilization.
Well, at least on the first parts of your questions, I think Tom Powers has already had a shot at some of that, Professor Bernstein.
Well, I'm not aware of any such agreements except things like Geneva Conventions, which are presumably allegedly to keep things like poison gas being used and so forth.
On a more informal basis, what about things like the Pugwash Conference?
Yes, that actually functioned very well even during the Soviet era. So that certainly was useful. I don't know. It may have led, directly or indirectly, to the test ban treaties and so on. So that certainly has been a very useful thing that's happened.
And briefly, I think Pugwash called for the place where the conference was first held in Nova Scotia, I believe.
Yes, and the leading person there is this very interesting guy, Joseph Rotblat, who was one of the few people who left the Los Alamos project as a matter of conscience. There are very few people who, I don't know of any others that did that. He had been at a dinner in which General Groves said that the real purpose of the bomb was the containment of the Soviet Union, and this upset Rotblat to such an extent that he actually walked out of Los Alamos, and he was the sort of founding father of the Pugwash, and he got a Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, so he's a very interesting fellow.
There's an interesting footnote to that. Rotblat had a second reason for leaving the effort at Los Alamos, and that was because he learned in late 1944 that there was no German bomb program. The British actually told him about this, and as soon as he realized that was the case, he quit because he had joined it only in order to have a counter to any possible German bomb.
Peierls once told me something very interesting. He said that he knew there was no German, serious German bomb program because of how the publications were going in Germany. I don't know how he knew what the publications were, but he somehow had access to German scientific publications during the war, and he noticed that most of the people you would imagine would be working on that sort of thing were publishing from their usual universities. So he concluded that they did not have something like Los Alamos. Of course, our physicist dropped out during the war and became invisible. So actually, I believe that the Russian scientists, I remember, were aware of the fact that we must have something going because the usual people publishing from the usual places had kind of vanished.
What about Tom's broader question about the benefits of nuclear technology, which I guess would include everything from medicine to electrical power plants, anything that justifies the developments of the nuclear weapons?
Well, so far, I'd say it's pretty scary.
Well, these equations are difficult. I mean, you know, what do you add up? The lives that have been saved because of the use of isotopes in medicine, and against the lives that were lost in Hiroshima, I think these moral equations are awfully difficult to make a lot of sense out of. So I don't know how one could answer that question, but it's a very good one nonetheless.
Tom, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Ray, who's on the line in San Francisco.
When we examine credibility of Heisenberg amongst his peers, it is of the highest order. And when we examine the chronology on the development of the theoretical physics that went into developing a nuclear weapon, the chronology suggests that a number of Heisenberg's peers, as well as he himself, felt that it was only a matter of time before a nuclear weapon could be built. And the question then is, would it be built? And he used his influence to steer the military in Nazi Germany away from a bombs program toward a nuclear power project. Would you care to comment on that?
Professor Bernstein?
Well, I think we've discussed that before. My position, which differs from Tom Powers, is that once you have the notion of plutonium and the use of reactors for making plutonium, then the distinction between a power program with reactors and a nuclear weapons program becomes blurred. So although the Germans said very often that they worked on the peaceable nuclear reactor, I don't think there is any such thing as a peaceable nuclear reactor. I think Tom doesn't agree with me, but that's my view of it.
Not to argue with you on that point, the question really is, when he looked at this in the long view and realized that a nuclear weapon could be built, the question that emerged in front of him, which he acted upon in a principled course, was to say, then I'll do everything I can to stall this, I'll finagle, I'll put them off on false trails, and make sure that this weapon is not developed by the Nazis as long as I can use my influence.
But I think that's a whole other question, but there are many more people who were involved in the German program than Heisenberg. It wasn't simply Heisenberg's program. There were in the early 40s there were sort of 60 people at more or less the professorial level.
Professor, let me interrupt you just for a second to say that I'm Neil Conan and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Please continue.
Well, there were some 60 people. There were 9 institutions involved. A man like Paul Hartak actually had one of the more useful inventions. He invented the ultracentrifuge for separating isotopes of uranium, which is the method that is used by third world countries now. So it was a large program, so it wasn't really a question of Heisenberg, I think, being able to shut it off by refusing to do this or that. I think it's more complicated than that.
We just have a couple of minutes left in this hour. I wanted to give both of you a chance to address a question: why you think, after all of this time, almost 60 years later, that this question is still of such burning interest. Professor Bernstein?
Well, that's one of the most intriguing questions to me, and I'm not sure I exactly understand it. I think it's because it's in the matrix of everything else that happened in Germany. In other words, if all the other things that the Nazis did hadn't been done, the Holocaust and all the rest, I think that people would perhaps feel a little more objective about this. But when you think of people like Heisenberg and even Hahn and those people working in that matrix, it can make you very angry. I mean, Heisenberg addressed audiences which included Nazis in uniform and so on, and you know, the thought of that, considering what those people are up to, just makes one angry, I'm afraid.
Tom Powers?
Well, I would say that Heisenberg himself was always very cautious in describing this. He never made any large claims for himself, but he did insist that moral considerations played a part in how he thought about these questions and also in what he did. And one reason I think it's still such a passionate question is that if you once accept the notion that somebody, and a German at that, had importantly affected the outcome of a bomb program for moral considerations, then you open up that whole question of whether or not it's right to build a bomb. Whether or not, as Heisenberg said, he asked Bohr in Copenhagen, it was right for physicists to work on uranium research in wartime. And the answer to that in Heisenberg's mind seems to me to have been no.
Thank you both very much.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank everybody who called and wrote this hour, and our guests, Thomas Powers, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, the author of Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb. He was with us from member station WVPR in Norwich, Vermont. And Jeremy Bernstein, who is a professor emeritus at physics at the Stevens Institute of Technology. He's the author of Hitler's Uranium Club, The Secret Recordings at Farm Hall. He was with us on the line from Aspen, Colorado. Earlier in the program, we spoke with David Kestenbaum, NPR science correspondent. Remember to tune in tomorrow when Talk of the Nation and Juan Williams broadcast live from Austin, Texas, as part of NPR's Changing Face of America. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of this program are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-TEXT.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, LexisNexis, providing decision support information and services to legal, business, and government professionals for more than 25 years, 800-227-4908, and the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation for coverage of health on the web at www.kff.org. This is NPR National Public Radio.
There are two classic American success stories, the entrepreneur who hits it big with a brilliant idea and the immigrant who succeeds through hard work. In Austin, Texas, the two stories often go together as the city has undergone a major economic shift. I'm Juan Williams. Join us for a live broadcast from Austin, Texas, part of our Changing Face of America series, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.